location, it seems to me, denotes real estate located somewhere at a specific point. But more importantly than what I think is what the Court of Appeals thought in the NS Associates case at 164 Wisconsin 2nd, page 53, where location is addressed in terms of a real estate interest.
Are all your sites leased? I'm talking about your sites where you have 106 signs. Are they all leased?
I believe that, Justice Wilcox, I believe the record is that virtually all of them are, and the trial was conducted such that all of them are.
Well, your flow has been interrupted. Counsel, what other personal property is there that's analogous to signs? In other words, the court makes a ruling in this case, what other kinds of property would be affected? And another way of putting it is, one way of wrapping your mind around an issue that you're not familiar with is to look at it in a broader context. So what else is out there?
Excuse me. What else is out there, Chief Justice, is cell towers, communication towers. And now I'm, of course, referring to the All-City Communications case, which was a sales and use tax case. But in that case, Judge Lunston, on behalf of the Court of Appeals, held that a 480-foot-tall steel communications tower with a foundation consisting of a lot of concrete into the ground, as you can imagine, plus 30 guy wires, each of which were sunk firmly into the ground, that was indeed personal property for sales and use tax purposes. And the principal reason that that court found that is, and I'm really arguing something that's unnecessary because everyone agreed in the Adams case, by the way, that signs are personal property, but I'm getting to a point, no matter how long it takes me, and that is that for sales and use tax purposes, it was held in that case that tower that I just described was personal property, and the principal reason being that cell tower was on a piece of ground that was leased by the owner of the cell tower, and the lease said two important things, getting at intent, which is the third test of a fixture, and that was, number one, the cell tower at all times remains the property of the tenant, and number two, at the end of the lease term, the tenant may remove its property from the real estate. That is the identical case that we have in this situation, and you couple that with the fact that the assessor admitted at trial that any cell towers that were assessed in the city of Madison would certainly be assessed on a cost less depreciation approach, and we had also an official from the Department of Revenue come into our trial and testify as to the same effect, that those cell towers, which he's responsible for assessing, are assessed as on a cost less depreciation approach. Income never.
But isn't the idea of assessment to get the truest value? I think that of the whatever they are assessing. The argument that the city makes is that the income method is more accurate and it reflects the true cash value of these billboards. Now, your argument is no, you've got the assessor's manual, they go through and you have to have comparable, say you have the three, what we call the three traditional methods. And why would you argue that, and I think Professor Aguilar, you mentioned, did not include costs when he, which are required to be included in the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual, which you refer to, and you're saying that, no, they've got to use that. And yet when he testified, the city says, your opposing party says, no, he didn't even use that.
Okay, what the city complained of in particular, as I recall, Justice Wilcox, is that Dr. Aguilar did not address a useful life kind of a sub issue as part and parcel of the depreciation issue. But in fact, Dr. Aguilar did assign a depreciation factor to the whole list of signs. And so that point was covered. Moreover, it is the case, and I think it's quite clear in the record, that Dr. Aguilar did include those costs that the city is complaining of that he did not include, and that was the citation to which I referred you.
Yeah, what was
Yes, it's Record 39, Exhibit 16, and that's the appraisal by Dr. Aguilar at pages 27, 29, and 30. Now, why do we argue that the income approach should not have been used, or I think your question more correctly was, isn't the income approach more accurate? Well, this leads to another point. I think the income approach is probably quite accurate in a lot of instances if we were before you in a condemnation case or an 84.30 statutes sign-taking case. And now we're into Vivid 4, which this court is very familiar with. By the way, Vivid 4, even though there was a three-person opinion and a four-person opinion that Justice Walsh Bradley wrote for the majority, all seven justices in that case, for condemnation purposes, indicated, it seems to our reading of the case, that the cost-less depreciation approach is a perfectly valid an acceptable method for which to value signs. But to get to your question, Justice Wilcox, an income approach takes in necessarily other elements than just personal property. It's our thesis and our main point here today, I think, above all others, that for personal property tax purposes, what must be valued is personal property. I think and it may be partially our fault. I think respectfully, the trial court got off the track a little bit in the opinion when Judge Sumi indicated a question that she stated quite clearly. I don't have it immediately in front of me, but it's not important. The question was, does the purpose for the valuation drive the method? And she said no. And I might not even disagree with that because I think the question was wrong. And I might have very candidly helped her get to the wrong question. I think there's a better question than that. The question is, does the purpose of the valuation drive what elements are to be included in the valuation? Or in other words, does the purpose of the valuation drive what is to be valued? And to that question, we say, emphatically, the answer is yes. For condemnation purposes, all those interests should be included. The structure, the permit value, the leasehold, and the location. Why? Because those are all the things that the sign company is losing in a classic condemnation case or an 8430 sign-taking case. But in a personal property tax case, we say signs are to be assessed as personal property. What is personal property among those four elements? The sign structure, and the sign structure only. And I can go into a little more detail on the other three if you wish me to, but at least by our measurement, the only thing that is a element of personal property here is the sign structure, and that's what should be valued.
What do you sell? If Adams were to sell this billboard in place, what would it sell it for?
If Adams were...
Fair market value is, for both personal property and real property, is that which a buyer and seller in the open market, right, et cetera. So what would you sell it for?
Well, in the very... First of all...
You have personality, right? We agree.
I'm sorry?
If this is personal property, okay, what are you going to sell it for?
Right. Well, first of all, sign structures and structures only are purchased and sold as structures and as a unit all the time. And there was ample testimony on that from Mr. Ulmer and Dr. Aguilar and from Mike Collins, all three. But I think the question you're getting at, if I may, Chief Justice, is that there are instances when sign companies, for example, will sell their whole inventory of signs to another company.
I just want to buy that one right near my house because I want to just buy that one.
That one sign?
Yeah.
And
I want it in place because I want to use it so that I can see it when I drive in every day.
If a sign company agreed to that transaction, you would want to buy, and hopefully you would be successful in buying, the sign structure,
right.
an assignment of the permit, an assignment of the lease, and obviously the location would come along. There's no question about that. And we concede that point.
However, is that the value of that sign in place?
To our way of thinking, no. The sign, first of all, the sign structure is something that can be easily pulled away from that lot and moved elsewhere. And there's a very critical point I must make at this point. When that happens, the permit does not run with the sign structure. It does not even stay with the land or the lessor. It, in fact, evaporates.
But Adams can sell it to me. Do I have to go to the city and get permission?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay, so that's a freely transferable issue. Is that intangible?
Well, one of the things you would be buying is an intangible. Two of the things you would be buying are intangibles. Two, I guess. Of those four elements, you would be purchasing an assignment of the permit. That's an assignment of an intangible in our view. And you would be purchasing the location for whatever positive worth that is. For example, it's uniquely situated, near the road so that motorists can easily see that sign. Those are intangibles in our view. And, if you'll forgive me, both the permit and the location are real estate interests, not personal property interests. But there's no question, Chief Justice, you're correct, that type of transaction can occur. Now, what more routinely occurs is either an outright sale of the whole company in a merger or a buyout-type acquisition. It actually happened preceding this case. Hanson Outdoor used to be one of the principal operators in the city. They sold to Adams, and that's why Adams is here and not Hanson. Those types of transactions occur. And again, in that transaction, all those elements would be part of it. But more pertinent to this case, in our view, is that sign structures and structures only are bought and sold all the time, absent permits, absent leaseholds. And that brings us to another point, and that's this. Mr. Ulmer, who wrote Chapter 23 of Nichols on Condemnation, he's probably the nation's leading authority in the area of sign valuation, made it very clear that he's well aware of all kinds of transactions when permits are separately sold, when leaseholds are separately sold, and when sign structures are separately sold. And then what happens, of course, is that the buyer somehow then acquires the other rights necessary to bring all those elements together in a marriage to make a significant value out of the whole.
Mr. Harnig, if I might, when I look at Section 70.34, it leads me to, and everybody else, I guess, to the conclusion that the property assessment manual is extremely important in valuation.
Is what, Justice?
The property assessment manual. Does the property assessment manual list the elements that are to be taken into consideration by the assessor when assessing in regard to personal property?
To my recollection and knowledge, the only things it says is that the personal property itself would be assessed and the costs, and it's framed in terms of costs, not values, the costs of putting it into operation, if you will. I believe that's a fair summary of what the manual includes, and I think it stops there.
Does the manual in any way list what is included within the term personal property? Or does it exclude anything?
The manual, to my recollection, only summarizes the body of law that exists in the state of Wisconsin that sorts out what is real estate and what is personal property. There are a number of, it's frankly kind of a short course on the law, and it includes a lot of case citations and so forth as to the difference. But it doesn't purport in and of itself to be an authority on that, but only to report what the statutes and the case law says on the matter. This brings us to an important point that we think is a starting point for distinguishing the waste management case, and I think the court may want to get into those inextricably intertwined cases. And that is that the definition in the statutes of real estate is quite inclusive, and whereas the definition of personal property is not. What do I mean by that? Well, the definition of of real estate, if I can just find it here quickly, and I'm looking at 70.03, it says that, that real estate includes not only the land itself, but all buildings and improvements thereon, and all fixtures and rights and privileges appertaining thereto. So that was the natural jumping off point for the waste management decision in 1994, authored by the Chief Justice, and for the ABCA decision in 1998, whose principal writer was Justice Walsh Battle. If you distinguish that from the definition of personal property in 70.04, and there it says that personal property shall include all goods, wares, merchandise, chattels, and some other things. But nowhere is there that tagline that says, and you include all these other things. So I think, whereas it was perfectly logical in waste management to include the value of the property as a waste site, because it was uniquely situated to be that, and there was even some discussion about the license there and the operation of the property. When you look at the definition of real property, in that real property tax case, the decision was perfectly logical. To stretch that inextricably intertwined body of law to now include a personal property tax case, to me, is the breaking point. And moreover, if one gets to that point, one has to ask, where does it stop? And if you will, I'm now offering you a floodgates argument here. It seems to me that once you attempt to extend collateral interests and attach those onto personal property for personal property tax cases, and don't stop with waste management and with ABCA, then I think the body of law in this area has a serious problem, because I don't see any place for that to stop. Seems to me the logical stopping point for that theory is real estate and real estate taxes.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. The particular properties where the billboards sit, I assume that those properties are also assessed for real estate tax purposes. Is that correct?
Yes, they are.
And who pays the real estate taxes, the owner or the lease?
The owner of the real estate, who is the lessor to the sign company.
And those real estate taxes would take into account the entire bundle of property and the value of the property. Is that correct?
If they don't, they certainly should, and I agree. And that's why we argue that to a certain extent, and here this argument came off the rails a little bit too, I think, in the court below. We argue that, in effect, there is a double taxation issue going on here, but it's not because we say that because the assessor used the income approach, that the income of Adams is being taxed twice. No, we don't believe that. The income method is just a method to get at the value of a property, and then that value is taxed on a property tax basis. I don't think that's a double taxation with income tax. But if for personal property tax purposes, all these other elements, which in our view are real estate elements, are coming into play here and being taxed to the sign company, and then the real estate owned by the lessor is also being taxed, I think there's a great danger of double taxation there.
Let me ask you one other question. You argue, and you've argued forcefully in your brief, that the city is using the income method in assessing the personal property here. But my understanding of the city's response, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the city is saying, yeah, we use the income method, but that's not the only method we use. We've used other methods as well. And given the Kesselman case, which is cited on page 10 of the trial court's decision, it seems that the trial court at least quoted this: in absence of such sales, the assessor may consider all the factors, and here's the key word, collectively, which have a bearing on the value of the property in order to determine its fair market value. Among the factors are cost, depreciation, replacement value, income, industrial conditions, location and occupancy, sales of like property, book value, and so on and so on. Is there anything, given that language, inappropriate about taking a broader view and using all of the factors, including income factor, if the city focuses on the income value of the structures and excludes out the value of the land and the value of the permit?
A complicated question and a complicated answer. Forgive me. Don Suddy was one of our experts that we presented at trial. Mr. Suddy said, yes, it was possible to use the income approach to ultimately get to the value of just the sign structure only. But he said what would have to be done is to essentially take the result that the Madison assessor wound up with and then, I think his phrase was, isolate out the various components that you just referred to. He said, yes, that could be done. It's probably a backwards way of accomplishing what would be accomplished much more directly by just using the cost less depreciation approach, which our brief, I think, covers.
But I guess the question is shouldn't the city be looking at both approaches?
Okay, and I didn't quite get to that, forgive me.
Gotcha.
Perfectly valid if you're into Tier 3. And I think this court is very familiar with the fact that there's a three-tier approach for property taxes. You look at any recent sales of the subject property, that's Tier 1. If there aren't any, you look for any reasonably comparable sales, that's Tier 2. And by the way, you don't go from 1 to 2 and 3 and include them all. You have to go one at a time. If there is Tier 1, you can use Tier 1 and Tier 1 only. If there is Tier 2, you must use Tier 2 and Tier 1 only. And that is one of our principal arguments in this case, is that contrary to the last 11th-hour supplemental report that was filed by the city assessor here, if you look at the testimony elicited in the adverse toward the end of day one, which is record 49, and you look at that testimony of the assessor, Mr. Kurth, you will notice in there a number of places where the assessor admitted in his deposition that he used, since 1994, the income approach and the income approach only. And that's where you get into a real problem with some of the authorities that this court is familiar with. That the income approach is never to be used exclusively. But you would only get there if you were in Tier 3. We say that there were ample, reasonably comparable sales just based on the fact that you could go to any supplier and find out what you could buy a sign structure for on a replacement cost basis, something that Mr. Ulmer pointed out, and then take your depreciation and add your extra cost to that.
And if I could, Mr. Horning, sorry, your red light just went on. I hate to ask this question beyond it, but did you submit evidence of those comparable sales at the trial court level?
May I answer?
Yes.
I'm sorry. We did not bring to the trial a body of evidence regarding comparable sales. What we did is bring in experts to say that comparable sales were very much available had the assessor cared to locate them, and we elicited in the adverse testimony of the assessor that since 94 he hasn't even attempted to find comparable sales. That's in the record. Thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant City Attorney Larry O'Brien, representing the City of Madison. Mr. O'Brien.
Forgive me, Your Honor, I'm a little, back's a little cranky still. We would have preferred, knowing that there would be an audience, to be able to present a bit more of a scintillating case for them, but we're stuck with what we have.
Well, we can make it more scintillating.
My name is, in fact, Larry W. O'Brien. I'm a Madison Assistant City Attorney, and I appear on behalf of the City of Madison. May this presentation please and persuade the court. As in all civil actions, Adams bears the burden of proof, and we want to keep that firmly in mind.
What about his comparable sale argument just made, counsel, that I know you had a last-minute filing, but is it true that in 94 that the city assessor never looked at comparable sales after that time? Is that you?
No, that is not the case at all.
What is the case?
The case is that our chief assessor, Mr. Kurth, did in fact look at sales at least from La Crosse. Those were the only available sales that he was able to find.
So he didn't look at any sales in there were no sales in Madison from 2004 until from 1994 until 2002. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Well,
for one reason, Adams owns most of the signs here in town. So when we looked at, or more accurately, Mr. Kurth looked at availability of signs, as I said in my brief, he explained to Judge Sunni why it was that the signs that were able to be located simply were not comparable. And if you recall my brief, he listed five reasons why they were not. I would point out, however,
the reason I asked that question is in the certification to this court, it appears that, and I'm just reading from page 16, that City of Madison is on the cutting edge of this issue in Wisconsin, perhaps nationally, and that they're using this method, unlike, as I gather, the other 49 states and maybe other cities aren't doing that. Why is that? Because there aren't comparable sales?
A couple of reasons. First, Madison, being what it is, decided to look at the...
Now, we could perform on Madison being what it is. You want to explain what you mean?
Justice Wilcox, what we were looking at with Mr. Kurth was how is the appropriate method of valuation of these signs. We saw that throughout the country, the industry has been able to convince municipalities for a variety of reasons that the cost approach is the only available method. We looked at it and said, no, we understand that by Adam's own admission that signs and the permits that are attached to them are bought and sold on the amount of money that the combination will generate or is potentially capable of generating. Mr. Hornig concedes, as does Professor Aguilar, that signs and the permits are sold at market value. Market value means income. Now, if you want to look only at comparable sales, the likelihood is that you're not going to find very many comparable sales.
But isn't that what you're supposed to do under the assessment manual that was referred to by Justice Crooks?
If there are comparable sales, if there are sales of truly comparable property, yes, you may look at those. But the Latham Smith Lodge case provides some exceptions to that. And the first one is whether or not the income, the use of the property is such that the income produced is its primary value. That's an exception to the ordinary rule of comparable sales being the second tier, and then you stop. In this case, we've established, actually with Adam's help, because they have provided income and expense records consistently, we have been able to determine that the income is, in fact, the primary source of revenue from the signs.
Counselor, I asked opposing counsel about Section 70.1121.
Yes.
And I phrased my question such that the list of examples looked like they were money substitutes, and he drew my attention back to the introductory phrase, which says that all intangible personal property is to be excluded. And I'd like you to tell me whether the city's appraisal includes the valuation of any intangible personal property.
You're obviously referring to whether or not the permit is intangible or a tangible asset.
And the leasehold, you know, whatever might be there, and the location, right?
Let me preface my comment and the answer to your question this way. Adams relies on deposition testimony. The supplemental report is in the record and is a part of the record. Because of that, and it was, I might add that it was admitted without objection. If that's the case, which it is, then Section 901.03 precludes raising the lack of, or the existence of the supplemental report. And that comes out of State versus Sonnenberg. If you don't object at the time, you
I'm
are
not about a supplemental report. I just want to know, does your appraisal include any personal property?
No, it does not.
It does.
What was the question? I didn't quite
The question is, does the appraisal of the city include the valuation of any intangible personal property?
No.
And your answer is no, it doesn't.
Chief Assessor Kurth, excluded the leasehold instance, the lease fee interest, the business interests, which would include profit center, marketing, artwork, all of that stuff. That's very, very clear and undisputed in the actual record. If we're talking...
You include the value of the permit, though, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Isn't that an intangible piece of personal property? What is it, then? It's either got to be real estate or personal fee, doesn't it?
Two-part answer. First, if you look at the waste management case, which I'm sure you will look at in great detail, you will note that the landfill license was never even considered to be tangible or intangible because it was inextricably intertwined with the landfill itself.
But that's a real estate valuation. We're talking about the valuation of personal property, and my question to you, isn't the permit intangible personal property?
No.
Okay.
And
what
the reason that I say that...
Tell me what it is. Put a label on it for me.
If you look at the Dane County Title Company case, back in 1957, this court found that the title records were, in fact, tangible personal property because they had a marketable value. Now, if title records had marketable value and were thus tangible, there is a cogent argument upon which we do not necessarily rely that the permit involved is equally tangible because it has a marketable value and the permit and the sign structure together are sold at market value.
Counselor, doesn't a bond have a market value, yet it's specifically excluded as an item of intangible property under 70.112?
The statute certainly includes that. The Dane County Title Company case referred to expressio unius exclusius alterius and said, we'll look only at the title records, and if something else comes up, that's what we're going to look at. And that's why I wrote in my brief that we're looking at this case. We're looking solely at how billboards are to be valued. I can come up with, I think, eventually, examples where the inextricably intertwined theory may not apply to other kinds of personal property. However, the only kind of personal property that really has a permit associated with it are sign companies. So our reliance on tangible, intangible is at best tertiary. We're looking at it that under the inextricably intertwined, well, a good phrase, theory, it doesn't make a hill of beans of difference. The court, Chief Justice Abramson, never even mentioned the issue of whether or not the landfill license was tangible or intangible. In our circumstance, that particular theory applied to the landfill license, even though the license itself would not automatically transfer to a subsequent owner. In our case, when the permit and the sign structure together are sold, the permit and the structure and the income which is generated by that active in-place sign is wholly transferred to the new owner. So if inextricably intertwined applied in waste management, it naturally follows, because the reasons are the same.
Mr. Brown, let me ask you this, because there's one thing that troubles me here.
Okay.
I just want to get a handle on this. As I understand it, if we're talking about the permit, the value of the permit, as I understand it, is already set on the front end because the permit is sold by the city to the person that buys the permit, correct? The entity that buys the permit.
Yes.
So the city sets the value and sells the permit. The city taxes the real estate as part of its real estate assessment.
The land that the county sits on.
So now we're talking about figuring the value of personal property, including the cost of the permit that the city has already sold and placed a value on. That seems to be troubling me.
Well, I hope I can ease your pain. Because if you look at the way Professor Aguilar noted how permits are valued when they're sold on the marketable value, if you review
the marketable value of what?
The permit. The permit itself. Now, if you look at Mr. Eigenberger's testimony at trial, he also indicated that when the permit is purchased, would he sell it for that amount of money? And he used the term, the dollar amount of $1,500. He says, absolutely not. I would sell that permit on the basis of what I have been saying now a number of times, on the amount of money that that permit and sign together will generate.
So how much does the permit cost?
I'm sorry?
How much does the permit cost?
I'm not real sure, but we were sort of using the amount of $1,500.
But if you sell the permit at the amount that it would generate, you've already taken that value into account when you sell the permit.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, I thought that's what you just said. Did I misunderstand you?
Perhaps. The permit is sold, we'll say, for $1,500.
Why don't you give an example where the permit is sold for $100?
Because will that make it easier?
I think so. Because I think the point you're trying to make is, you know, you can go to the government and buy a permit, but it isn't the value of this $100 permit or $500 permit, but the point you're trying to make is the amount of money that the permit together with the sign will generate, right? Isn't that your point?
Two sales here. One, sale from government to sign company.
Okay.
Second sale from sign company A to sign company B. First sale, $1,500. Second sale, megabucks.
Because it depends on the location, doesn't it?
It depends somewhat on the location, to be sure. But because Kurth took out the leasehold and leased fee interest, all that land interest is taken out before he even starts on the income approach.
You indicated that Madison had thought creatively about using the income approach for these billboards. Has Madison thought creatively about using this approach in other personal property?
Yes.
Such as?
The problem, of course, comes that most personal property, we value buildings on leased land, for example, rental property on the income approach. The other kinds of personal property, number one, don't have permits attached to them, so the issue is a little different. The kinds of things that Counselor over here suggested, number one, are not similar to a billboard. And secondly, the owners of other kinds of personal property other than buildings on leased land, rental property, things along that line, we simply don't have income information on.
Well, let me ask, you talk about permits. Are permits and licenses equivalent?
I beg your pardon.
Are permits and licenses equivalent?
Generally speaking, yeah. You can have a liquor license, for example. We call them liquor licenses. By the same token, you can have billboard permits. Well, so I'm not sure that there's a huge difference
let's
there.
Let's say there are two buildings, two restaurants, with the same kind of equipment inside, tables, and one has a liquor license. Is that assessed at a higher value?
No.
Why not?
The commercial property itself would be valued on the income approach, whether or not there's a license attached.
I mean, you assess the personal property in these restaurants, don't you?
Yes.
And isn't it possible that the building with the liquor license would generate more income?
Because of the personal property?
Well, you're using that same...
There's a refrigerator in this facility.
Yeah, there's a refrigerator, there's stoves, there's microwaves.
Right. So how do you value them?
Cost approach.
Okay. And that's true whether they've got that one restaurant has a liquor license next door and this restaurant doesn't. Same value. And then Justice Prosser is saying, yeah, but that refrigerator holding liquor is making much more money for the person than the refrigerator holding apple sauce.
Well, we wouldn't get down to that level.
But your response was that you value the license in the commercial property. What part of the commercial property is personal property that you value the liquor license in? That's another way of asking that problem.
The equipment. We value the equipment.
What kind of equipment?
Those things that you just listed, refrigerators, bars, taps.
You said you do that on cost basis.
Yes.
It's nothing to do whether they make more money out of it.
Correct.
Or not. Okay. What?
Because those items are generally not sold.
Okay. In what part of the business, tavern or a restaurant, is there any personal property in those businesses that you value using the license? Is that another way of phrasing your question?
Yeah. None.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Let's say we have two buildings with computers in them, except the computers in one building are really a website that reaches the world and sells all kinds of property. I mean, the income generated by that computer and the website related to that computer.
If it were sold on the basis of the amount of money that that computer generated, if it were sold on that basis, it's conceived, and we had the actual income and expense figures related to that operation, we would then look very seriously at using the income approach. The situation is, in your example, that computer is not sold on that basis. It's just not sold.
Well, there's a website.
Well, the website is separable from the computer itself. The two are not equivalent.
Also, I want to go back to Justice Prosser's question and then the Chief's question also. It seems to me there are a certain number of licenses you have in any community. I'm talking about liquor licenses.
Yes.
And if you don't have a liquor license, and I think this is what Justice Prosser was getting at, is that the business itself is generally, and I think this is sold for less than a business that doesn't have one. In other words, in most communities, they have a number of licenses.
You
can get one of those licenses, and that is if you get a license to sell liquor, and it's particularly important in a restaurant, the value of that restaurant, the going value, and I think, and just without getting you diverted, is normally worth more than one that doesn't have a license.
Generally speaking,
that's
true.
That's where the question was going. You're saying that as far as Madison is concerned, they don't place any value on that, correct?
First, the cost of the permit or the cost of the license is merely the administrative cost. It has nothing to do with income. Secondly, the idea that, that the licensed establishment will sell or not sell for more than the unlicensed establishment does not take into account the idea that the license does not transfer either to the new owner or to a new location, unlike what we're talking about here. So it doesn't have any, the two are not comparable in my mind.
Because it takes a vote of the city council or the to determine whether the license will transfer or not if this place is sold.
Two parts. One, Yes. Second, unlike the waste management situation where the DNR must approve a license who is qualified, the city council is not similarly required. There are a whole bunch of variables that may go into that decision to grant a transfer of that liquor license.
Thank you.
I want to just kind of step back and try to look at the big picture. If I wanted to go and buy a sign from ABC Sign Company, and it was a sign that was 20 feet by 40 feet in dimension, and that cost me, and I'm just going to pick a number, $10,000. And I take that sign, and I take it home and put it in my backyard.
Why on earth would you want
that? Because it says Elect Bradley or something like that.
Badly.
No one else wants it.
Me. Bradley.
Thank you. It seems to me the value of that on day one or day three or day five after purchase is probably $10,000 minus something. I don't know. You know. But if I take that same sign and put it at a different location, let's say the intersection of I-90 with the Beltline, it seems to me that the value of that is different. I mean, I'd pay more. I'd pay more to put that sign there because it's worth more. I mean, it just makes sense. It's worth more there than it is in my backyard because I want to try to influence people. I've got people driving on I-90 in the Beltline. So I know in Vivid, the court wrote that location in outdoor advertising sign plays a part, that the value of outdoor advertising sign is more than just the sign structure and is derived largely from the location of the sign. Now, Vivid, we dealt with just compensation. Here we're looking at fair market value. But it seems to me that I almost don't have to read a lot of the cases that I've written and looked at the statutes to say, the value of that sign is more when it's on I-90 than in my backyard.
First off.
The fair market value of that sign.
First off, you can't move the sign. The sale is the sign in place.
Okay, so that gets to my real question. What part of location is involved in the value of the sign, the fair market value of the sign?
Of the personal property alone.
Personal property.
Kurth removed the value of the location in terms of valuing the sign itself. He took out the leasehold interest. He took out the leased fee interest. Therefore, he took out all value that was related to location. That left the structure, the permit, and the income generated by that combination there.
Counselor, isn't the permit for a specific location?
Yes.
Then how can you say he took out all value of the location if he left the value of the permit in?
Because when you take out the value of the location, you take out the value of the real estate. That leaves the value of the structure and the permit.
Right, but the permit is location specific. You can't just use it anywhere, correct?
You use it at that location, correct.
Right.
And that's where the income is generated.
So, to answer my question, he took out the value of the real estate, the real property in terms
yes.
of location, but he didn't take out the value of the concept of location. That is, that it is more valuable, a fair market value of a sign with a permit for that sign at a certain location is more valuable depending on the location.
Yes. I mean, that's you know, almost patently obvious.
Let me phrase Justice Bradley's question a little bit differently. And I recall an election a few years ago where then circuit judge went out and purchased a number of signs from a sign company. and purchased at a set price. This, I want X number of signs. I'm going to purchase them, and it's my responsibility to take them out and locate them at the various locations that I want to locate them at. And my understanding is that when you go to the sign company, the signs are at a particular cost. It doesn't matter who comes in to purchase them. You go in, you buy the signs, then you figure out where the location is. You go out and you place them in the location, and if you're smart and get the best locations, you get the best bang for your buck. It doesn't increase the value of my sign, but it increased the value of the advertisement that went up on the sign. And so I get back, if we're talking about the fair market value, and that's why I keep coming back, fair market value of what? Are we talking about the fair market value of the sign? If you take out the location, as you say the assessor did, it would seem that you're left with the structure. But you're saying it's structure and permit. And if it's structure and permit, and I think this goes to Justice Rosenstein's question,
yeah,
that leaves in the location. And so it seems that there's a mixture of apples and oranges there. Now, in the example I used, you can go out, you can buy the signs, you can pick your own locations, you can put them out as long as you have the permission of the people on the property to set them up there. But the fair market value of the sign didn't increase. The sign stayed the same.
And your question is?
You seem to be putting in the location, putting back in location. I think I'm following Justice Rosenstein's question. You're keeping location in there. And yet you say the assessor's taking location out, and I'm having trouble seeing how the location is removed. You understand what I'm getting at?
I'm trying.
All right.
All I can tell you is from the professional accounting and appraisal practice that when the value of the leasehold interest, which is the value of the ground upon which this land, the sign sits, you've taken out that aspect of, we may be in a situation where we're using location in two different ways.
Okay.
One, location. Here's the piece of ground that the sign structure sits on. The location, which is valuable, is where, in fact, you place the sign. When Kurth took out the leasehold interest, he took out this part. Now, and that left the sign and the permit and all the rest of the stuff that goes along with it into the personal property tax valuation. So location has the two different meanings.
But the location was, you had the leasehold on I-94, but you also considered the fact that it was located on I-94 rather than on Highway 12.
Correct.
Mr. O'Brien, did there used to be more billboards in Madison than there are now?
I'm sure there were, highway beautification and the Wisconsin equivalent. That's where a lot of the stuff, that's where all the Vivid cases came from.
Okay, and when the owners of those billboards were told to take them down some way, what happened to them?
Eminent domain theory. What happened to the signs? I have no idea. Perhaps they could either have been destroyed, the structures may have gone to some other company. I have no idea.
But the eminent domain paid when the city took those signs.
Absolutely. That's what we're talking about. Difference between eminent domain theory, take out the necessary items, leaving personal property.
What I'm trying to get at is if they weren't destroyed, if I had 10 signs and because of city policy, I could only have 5 signs. I would have 5 signs that I should dispose of. Now, what would Justice Bradley, who has a company in Wausau, what would she pay for those signs?
Without advertising on them, I'd have to assume, and Tom here can correct me if I'm wrong, at that point in time, the permit would have expired because you're physically moving the sign, and I'm assuming that they would be costed out, not certainly based on the income because the income doesn't exist anymore.
I'm assuming if you took it by eminent domain, you own the signs. You dismantled them.
I'm sorry?
I said if you took these signs by eminent domain, I'm assuming you paid for them, you got the signs.
Well, the state... pretty much generally did all that.
Yeah. So the state has the signs, not Adams, not Vivid, not...
I don't know what they'd do with them. Maybe they'd sell them at cost.
Maybe.
I don't mean to be flippant about it, but...
the state also. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Well, I'm sure glad I worked so hard on my presentation.
Mr. Hornig?
Yes, Chief Justice, may it please the Court. At the outset of his remarks, Mr. O'Brien was asked whether or not it was true that the city assessor ignored comparable sales and failed to look for them, and his answer was absolutely not. That was not true. I respectfully refer the Court to the record at 49, page 78. This is from my adverse examination of the assessor on day one of the trial. And I need to read just one question and one answer. Question, it's true, is it not, however, Mr. Kurth, that since 94 and even previously, you have not looked for evidence of comparable sales of signs in order to value Adam's signs? Answer, correct.
Mr. Hornig, okay, let's for a moment say the city didn't look at comparable sales. All you did was say they didn't look at comparable sales. You put in no comparable sales. Right.
What we did was something different, Chief Justice. We had an appraiser do a complete formal appraisal on a cost approach, and that, in effect, we argue, is comparable sales in and of itself, and here's why. That appraisal started with the replacement cost, as of the time of the appraisal, of all of the signs and the various configurations and sizes in the city of Madison. And that would be the starting point for any comparable sales of sign structures only, would be what do you pay for them brand new? And he did that analysis. Then he took depreciation from that. So our argument is that, in effect, Dr. Aguilar's appraisal virtually was a comparable sales analysis of itself, except it was just on a cost-less depreciation type of basis. I think it's very important. I only have...
The assumption is that the fair market value of this structure is limited to cost-less depreciation.
I would answer the question this way. And it comes back to the most fundamental point that we're here to argue, Chief Justice, and that is this is a personal property tax assessed to the owner of the sign structure, which is Adams. It's not the owner of the ground.
Right. Got it.
And the question is, what do you then assess?
Right.
Comes down to that. I would like to just very, very briefly, or at least rapidly, list for you the support that there is for the cost-less depreciation approach for assessing signs in this country. First of all, there are three Department of Revenue cases that are in the record that are dead on point. The Department of Revenue in this state is on record saying cost-less depreciation is the correct way to go. There's a California study that resulted in that method. The Florida study did. The Michigan case, which is Auburn Hills, which is in our brief. The city of Madison's own approach before 1994, the city of Madison's approach for every other kind of commercial personal property in the city is on a cost-less depreciation approach, except for one little area, and I think Justice Butler elicited that, and that is buildings on leased property. It was elicited in the record that those buildings on leased property are there almost all cases on a 99-year lease with no provision in the lease that the building remains the property of the tenant and no provision that the building can be removed at the end of the 99 years for quite obvious reasons. Obviously, it's virtually a real estate tax, and that's how it is done. That's the only exception that Mr. O'Brien today could point to, and it's the only exception I can guarantee you in this record as to what the city does on an income basis other than Adam's signs. Dr. Aguilar supports the cost basis. Mr. Ulmer, who wrote Chapter 23 on Nichols on condemnation. Mr. Suddy, the very tax return that the city of Madison uses is called Statement of Personal Property. The virtually every other jurisdiction in the nation. And one of the justices, I apologize, I don't remember which, brought out that point, that there are, with the exception of two or three cities in the state of Wisconsin, all with ties back to Madison, by the way, there are no other jurisdictions using this approach to our knowledge. We respectfully urge the court to follow what is quite apparent to us to be the vast majority of jurisdictions who have studied the problem and have come to the conclusion that is the correct way to do things. I'm very frank here to say that it is perfectly possible that there is something else that an assessor may do someday with respect to the real estate where some of these signs are sitting. But those are that's an issue for another day. That's not our case. This is not a real estate property tax case. This is a personal property tax case. We don't have a merger of all the interests here like occurred in waste management, where the owner-operator operated the landfill site, owned the license, owned the ground, and so forth. In this case, those interests are very diverse and separated out, and my time is up, and I apologize.
I'm wondering if I could very quickly. Let's say for purposes of this question that this court agrees with you and sends this back. I want to ask once again the question, if the city were to factor out the value of the permit, is there anything inappropriate about using the income approach in conjunction with the other approaches, using the collective approach that Kesselman talks about?
If the city were to use the income approach as a starting point and factor out location, which it did not do, and I think a couple of questions from justices brought that out, did not take out location. If they also took out the permit, and if they also took out the full leasehold interest, which I'm not convinced has come out, if those three elements came out and you were down just to the structure at the end, absolutely there's nothing wrong with it, and our expert, Mr. Suddy, agreed. However, we simply argue that it's the wrong way around to get to the same point. And may I say very quickly, we urge this court not to send this back. And under 7437, indeed, it does not have to. This court can adopt, in this one case, Dr. Aguilar's appraisal and conclude the case once and for all at that point. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Hornig, and thank you, Mr. O'Brien, for your very informative and helpful oral arguments this morning. That concludes our argument in 2005 AP 508, Adams Outdoor Advertising versus City of Madison. The students should remain here, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily. The court will meet in conference at 11:20 promptly, and we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, and then we will hear additional oral argument. We are in recess.